Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this New Books Network podcast. My name is Katriana Gold, and today I'm very excited to be speaking with Stefan Mao about his new book, Sorting Machines, The Reinvention of the Border in the 21st Century. Stefan Mao is professor of macrosociology at the Humboldt University of Berlin. His new book was released with Polity Press in December 2022, having originally been released in German in 2021. This English edition was translated by Nicola Barford and is essential reading for students and scholars of international ability. In the book, Stefan argues that far from becoming more permeable in the era of globalization, borders are in fact shifting in nature, becoming more selective in ways which reflect and compound certain forms of inequality. Without further ado, welcome to New Books Network, Stefan.
Hi, nice to be here.
Great, happy to have you. So, I'd like to start by asking you a bit about your academic trajectory. This book is, of course, only the latest in a series of fascinating publications, and you're quite explicit in the book about how some of the research projects you've been involved in inform the arguments you make here. So I think our listeners would benefit from an overview of that earlier work and how it ultimately led you to write this book.
So my background is inequality research, so in a broader sense. So I'm a sociologist by training and did my studies in Berlin at a free university. And then I went to the European University Institute in Florence, where I worked on a project that compared Britain and Germany in terms of social policy, the so-called moral economy of welfare states. And then for many years, I was professor at the University of Bremen, so northern part of Germany. And there, my interest in borders began, at least my scientific interest. So I had a long-standing project in a larger research context working on the transformation of statehood. And the basic idea was to ask whether the state as we know it, the container state, so the highly regulated state, the form of state sovereignty that was known for decades, is somehow transforming into something else. And I was working on borders, mainly on borders of the OECD world. So we did a comparison of Austria, Finland, and the US. So somehow unusual cases. And there we realized for the first time that selectivity is a big issue when you look at borders. And what we did at that time, we compiled data on visa waiver programs across the globe for all countries you can imagine. So 200 times 200 countries and for two times. And then you could really see what is going on because it's a very good indicator for the freedom to move or the right to mobility. And then I moved to Berlin a couple of years ago to Humboldt University. And here I have a new project on borders, and the book was basically a sum up, broader overview of the many insights we made, many of them in collaboration with other researchers, and also related to publications, journal publications we did earlier, and so it was just a way to put together a very concise, and more structured overview of the many different transformations borders undergo. I should also mention that there's a biographical facet to my interest in borders. So I come from East Germany, and in November 1989, when the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall came down, I was did my military service in the East German National or People's Army. And so you can imagine that was quite a crucial biographical experience that led me somehow to an ongoing interest in borders and the way borders shape societies. And so I kept always an eye on border issues.
Right, that's super interesting. Especially the biographical component. Let's get into your core argument. As you say, I think the book is a really excellent overview of a lot of border-related issues. I really appreciated both its breadth and also its concision. It's very measured and it's very clear about the research you're drawing on, and avoid overreaching at any point. It's an incredibly well-argued text and very compelling throughout. And I think a good place to start with talking about your core argument would be with your third chapter on the dialectic of globalization. So I really like this term, and I wanted to ask you to tell our listeners, what is this dialectic of globalization and how your understanding of globalization differs from common sense understandings of the term or of globalization as a process?
Yes, of course. If we use the term globalization, then we have something in mind, namely the movement across borders. So everything becomes more open, and it's more easy to cross borders, not only for people, but also for capital, for products, for cultural artifacts. So everything moves freely. And in the 90s, we had a big discussion on the effects of globalization on the capacity of nation states basically to control borders. And one of the key understandings of that literature was, maybe globalization is something like a flood. So leaving the nation state basically unable to sufficiently control its borders, so they are forced to open up. On the one hand, of course, to reap the benefits of the globalization. So if you want to become a part of that, then you have to do something. You cannot stay aside like North Korean dictator can. But on the other hand, but also because of the enormous forces of globalization that basically have an impact on the nation state and the way it controls its borders. And so we had many terms on how to describe globalization. One was deterritorialization, so the emergence of transnational social spaces, but also the world is flat, or we are moving towards a world without borders. But a closer look already 20 years ago could tell you that this is not the case. And it's not the case, not only because you find still that borders are working and existent, but that globalization itself produces new borders and new forms of bordering. My claim in the book is that there's a co-constitutive relationship between debordering and rebordering. So, and I use, I have two different terms for that. I say there's an opening globalization, that's the one I have just described, and there's a so-called closure globalization. So that globalization itself drives a reinforcement of borders, not of old borders as we know them, but also of new borders that have shifted their place. So the location of control, it works with new forms of technology that also uses so-called macro-territorial borders within the context of regional integration projects, and that is highly selective. And these different elements together, they are basically part and parcel of the new borders. And this is a basic idea to say, globalization takes place, but it has two facets. There are two sides of the same coin. And one is make it easier to travel across borders, to move across borders. And the one is make it more difficult, make it harder to cross borders, always depending on the specific group you are talking of. And so the term sorting machine, that is the title of my book, is basically describing that kind of reorganization of borders, namely becoming more permeable for some and more close and difficult to cross for many others. And if you look at the numbers, for example, then we know that just a very small part of the world population actually travels across borders, and not only for lack of resources, the others don't do it, but mainly for reasons that they are excluded from other states, from entering other territories.
Right. And as an inequalities researcher, you're sort of well positioned to write and think about how these kind of questions of bordering intersect with broader questions of inequality. On page 36, I think you write, without the interventions that immobilize parts of the world's population and exclude them from the benefits of globalization, it would scarcely be possible to reduce or remove borders for others. And this dynamic looms very large throughout the book, and especially in your fifth chapter, which I'd like to hear more about. I want you to talk a bit more about how and why contemporary bordering practices do increase mobility for some while decreasing mobility for others, and what this does have to do with inequality writ large on various scales. And perhaps you could give our listeners some contemporary examples of this sort of filtering. I mean, you talked about visa waiver programs earlier, maybe more along those lines would be interesting.
Yeah, I go back to our visa waiver data set. That is quite an interesting data set, because it really tells you to what extent the global patterns of mobility have shifted. For example, so we started first year of collecting these data was 1969. And if you look at the pattern at that time, you are quite surprised to see countries which you wouldn't expect at the top of the global mobility hierarchy. So sometimes people talk about the power of passports. So in how many countries can you travel with your passport without applying for a visa beforehand? And a visa is always a very strong barrier to mobility, because it's costly, it's time intensive, and you can also be denied a visa. And we can see that many people from African countries, for example, they could easily travel to Europe, not to all countries, but to many countries, to Belgium, to Austria, to Germany, to the UK. And over time, over the last 50 years, this has shifted, and in particular, to the benefit of the Northern Hemisphere, in particular to the benefit of the OECD countries, of the rich democracies of the world. They have increased their power of passports, whereas African country citizens have less power now in terms of traveling. So some can only travel to one or two or three countries without a visa permit, whereas people from Britain or from Germany, they can travel to more than 100 countries across the globe. And I claim in that book that people from rich democracies could extend their travel opportunities at the expense of the exclusion of others. And so there's a causal relationship between these two, and there's a very strong international or global mobility hierarchy, how one could call that. And if you think that mobility is a very high value, so the ability to move freely, to change your place of location, has a very high value in our lifestyle, then we can automatically say, so this has happened to the disadvantage of most of the world's population. Sigmund Baumann, one of the key persons I'm referring to in that book, has had this very nice expression: some inhabit the globe, others are chained to place. So this is basically an effect of globalization. Why is it that the case? Globalization would probably not be thinkable if we would open up all borders for all people, because then states really would lose their ability to control. They would lose their ability to tax people. They would lose their ability to provide security for their populations. So they have to be selective to some extent. And the stronger impact on inequality is a side effect of the ongoing interest in control and protect territories. And so in the long run, one could say there's a very predominant mobility pattern. We mostly see mobility between rich countries and then mobility from rich countries to poor countries, very little mobility between poor countries. And I'm using the term mobility instead of migration, because most people think when we talk about borders, we talk about migration, because the most frequent border crosses is a mobile person, being mobile in terms of business travel, in terms of visiting family members, in terms of tourism, rather than migrating to another country. Just 1 out of 1,000 approximately border crossings are related to migrations. Most others are related to some other kinds of movements. And that is very important to realize that borders are not only about migration. They are mostly about mobility, though there, of course, there is an inherent link to migration, because why do we exclude people from coming to other countries? Because we assume that they might be migrants or visa overstayers. So they come with a legal document and then they stay on after the visa has expired. And this kind of assumption that is kind of basic condition of non-trusting other people that, of course, leads to specific types of exclusion. I should add maybe one or two interesting figures. So if you look at the data, 80% of the world population has never entered a plane. It's quite surprising, because we think this is a standard social experience, but it isn't. Per year, just 2 or 3% of the world population uses a plane to go to another place. So it's really a very tiny global mobility aristocracy, if you like, that crosses borders easily, that is a frequent traveler, whereas for many others, the experience of globalization is an experience of exclusion, is an experience of being chained to place, as Sigmund Baumann has put it.
So immobility as actually, or relative immobility as the norm, and that's something that, especially as academics, I think we can tend to forget or it can fall out of view. This conversation also connects really well to your 7th chapter on macro territories, so dismantling internal borders, upgrading external borders. I don't know if you want to talk here about that, but I think you talk in a really compelling way there about the ways in which internal opening and external border security are interrelated, for example, in the European Union. And that obviously connects with what you were just talking about there and some people's mobility.
Yeah, I mean, the EU described itself as a largest mobility-free zone all over, though the self-description is a little bit irritating and misleading because it does not properly capture what they have in mind. But of course, we have a deinstitutionalization of internal borders within the Schengen space. And most people say, so Germany has no borders anymore because you can go to France or to Denmark or to the Czech Republic or to Poland without a document, and you hardly realize that you enter a different country. Apart from the street signs or the number plates of the cars. But in fact, these borders have shifted to the outside borders of the Schengen areas. And so there's a collective border. And all the discussions that we have about the Mediterranean Sea or the border between Poland and Belarus, and we can easily see that there's a hardening of borders taking place, or what we call border fortifications are being built up. And so also an interesting figure, I think, when you look at the overtime development of border walls across the globe, then there's an enormous increase. So in the 80s, we had 12 or 13 border walls worldwide. Now we have nearly 80. And so 6-7 times more. Every fifth border across the globe is now a fortified border. So it was just 5% in 1980. And so this happened exactly the same time when globalization took place. So when a moment of de-bordering took place, all these new border walls emerged, and not just in Europe, but at all continents. You also find that South Africa is building borders, Saudi Arabia is building borders, Brazil is building hard borders. So everywhere these kind of border activities or the border building activities are taking place. And yeah, exactly when we talk about the world is becoming more flat and we are all now interconnected.
Right. Yeah. They're re-bordering at the same time as de-bordering, or it's just a movement of borders, right? I think you also write earlier in the book compellingly about what factors relate to or determine whether a border is a hard border or a relatively fortified border. And again, that connects back to those questions of inequality we discussed earlier.
That's true. So we did some research where we basically try to categorize all land borders across the world. So in terms of, is it a fortified border? Is it a landmark border? Is it a checkpoint border? So we have four different or five different categories. And we try to explain, where do we find hard borders? And is that related to maybe cultural differences in terms of dominant religion? So between Christian and Muslim countries, is it somehow related to differences in the political system? So do dictatorships build more walls than democracies? And what we see, what the strongest effect the welfare gap or sort of inequality gaps between neighboring countries. So if we have large differences in terms of the GDP, then it's very likely that the richer country builds a border fence or a border wall, and so in order to protect itself from not wanted migration or forms of mobility. So it relates somehow, so these kind of global hierarchies of mobility, but also the existence of hard borders or fortified borders relates very much to the inequality issue. And so the global perspective tells you, is very telling in that respect, that without a highly unequal world, we probably would have a totally different mobility regime, but also totally different borders.
Right. Yeah. And speaking of the nature of borders, in addition to their shifting physical form, we could talk about your sixth chapter, Smart Borders, Informational and Biometric Control. So maybe changing tack a bit, you talk here about the border as a data extraction point and a site where new technologies of risk classification are enacted. And you also discuss how such borders, smart borders, are increasingly connected with other forms of surveillance and data collection. So China's social credit system or the US requirement that visa applicants provide their social media accounts for inspection. And of course, there's a longer history of interconnections between the government of mobility and other security concerns and databases. Like in my research on the Cold War, I found extensive data sharing between the US Passport Office and the FBI. But now the scope and nature of contemporary practices does seem to have shifted, obviously enabled by technological developments in the meantime. So maybe you could say a bit more about that. What is a smart border and why does all this matter?
Yeah, the smart border, it's a term that is used for two aspects. So one is basically the surveillance of the border line or border regions, so with technical means or technological means. But the other one is more important for me on the book, the change of control technologies at the border. So the old border, basically, how did it function? You went there, you had a passport, you had maybe a visa stamp, and you gave your passport to a border guard, and this person checked it and looked whether the photography looks like you, and then you could pass or you were rejected. Now, very often, the border already knows you when you approach the border. So there are pre-stored information, very often biometric information, fingerprint, iris scan. So this is a data point where you enter, and then you are automatically checked with a pre-stored information that is then related to your body. And we also have a development of so-called ABC borders, so automated border control forms, where no officer is needed anymore. You know that from airports very often. You have smart tunnels or smart crossing points where certain information on you as a person is pre-stored, and you are, of course, very well identified via biometric information. So you do not feel the border anymore. We have that at different Asian airports. You use an app, you upload your information, and it's always stored there, and you do not feel the border anymore because it functions like a supermarket automatic drawer. You approach it, the border recognizes you, it opens, and then it closes once you passed. And this is a very interesting development because it also means that for those who are welcome travelers, the experience of the border will basically disappear. You will not feel the border anymore. For many others, the border will stay closed, and you will have the feeling, so there is no border anymore. I can move freely everywhere. So it's basically, it's an open space. The world is really reachable for me, whereas all the other people make the opposite experience. For them, it's even more rigid. And the difference, these systems, very often they use algorithms to classify people into either trustworthy travelers or risky or less trustworthy travelers. There are now a larger number of so-called trusted traveler programs, and they all are based on the same idea, namely you give data more than you normally would provide when you cross a border. You give data voluntarily, and in return, you are part of the fast lane when you cross a border. It's more convenient. You don't feel the border anymore. And many people, of course, when you see a long line at the airport, they might want to shift to a smart tunnel or a smart border, where control is not intervening into your mobility as much, and where you do not feel control anymore. As a UK person, you probably have the experience after dropping out of the European Union that the queues at the airport are not that fantastic and that they get longer. And this is, of course, a very strong incentive to take part in a trusted traveler program. And the more data you offer, the better might be your status and the more privileged you are when you cross borders.
Right, yeah. And there's also this question about data sharing that isn't necessarily visible to the traveler, right, at the time that they travel. It seems like there's increasing, I think you say, interoperability between various databases about risky travelers, so on and so forth.
Yes, exactly. I mean, now it's not only the body that is crossing borders and circulating, but it's also the data related to the body. And there are more and more technology firms use so-called identity management systems where you once give your data, and they are used for very different purposes at different places. So you use them only once when you travel, and then they move along with you to the next checkpoint, to the next desk where you have to enter. And we also have a situation where border control becomes very similar to other forms of control in the public space, even indistinguishable. And the technology firms that offer these kind of systems are also the same. One US firm I mentioned in the book is called Clear. They were founded after 9/11, and now they say so the coronavirus, for example, was a very big business opportunity for them, because we all had apps downloaded on our mobile phones where we had information stored on our health status, on our traveling history, that were used then to enter restaurants or public spaces or libraries. And so you see that these kind of control using biometric information, a QR code, and so on, they can be also be used at the border or at any other place, at a public stadium or at a university campus, where you want to select people, have some people in, and want to exclude some others. And I think we have really a diffusion of forms of controls into the public space, which make the difference between a border and a control within the public space indistinguishable. This is also a tendency that you see in terms of shifting borders. This is a term that is used by many now in the literature, saying that we need a new understanding of the border. The border is not a border line where two territories meet, but a border is there where control takes place. And that can be at many different places. So we have a diffusion of control into the public space. For example, if you use surveillance systems at public places, at stations, or I don't know, in the tube, then you can always recognize people with facial recognition systems, and do the same. So if they are not wanted or if they are not entitled to be at a specific place, with the same type of technology that you use at the border. So and then you might not need border control at the border or at the entry point anymore, because you can find people everywhere. So whenever they appear at a public space, you can recognize them and try to classify them as being either eligible to be there or to be someone who has entered a territory without a permit or without being legal at a specific territory.
Right. That's one of the most interesting aspects of these new developments. As we move towards the end of our interview, one thing I definitely want to make sure we cover is your theoretical and scholarly influences. I mean, you've mentioned a few, and like I said, in this book, you address a whole array of border-related questions in a way that's very measured and empirically led. but also theoretically engaged. And you provide some really helpful signposting of a number of key theorists and fellow researchers in text. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about your key scholarly influences in writing this. Whose work really shaped your thinking on borders and mobility?
Yes, I mean, theoretical influences, they come from people like Ulrich Beck and Sigmund Baumann. So, of course, big theorists of modernity, but they also, both of them had a very strong interest in globalization. And they have very early on highlighted the ambivalences of globalization. And this is something I have followed. There are a number, of course, of migration researchers I'm interested in, mostly people who work more on the empirical front, not so grand theorists. So I try to link to different types of discourses. So it's not as I said before, some people think, yeah, it's migration research. I said, no, it's not. It's related to the way states organize border control and influence or structure mobility. And one person that I'm highly also, where I think the work is extremely interesting, is a legal scholar, Eilert Schacher. She has written a very interesting book on the birthright lottery. So how citizenship is basically allocated and the rights and duties that go along with citizenship and how this can be justified. But she has also recently worked on borders and shifting borders. So this is the term that comes from her. And she has also published a book on shifting borders, where she is looking at basically the legal implications of moving borders and border controls away from a territory, because we know that the legal system is very much based on an idea of territorial sovereignty. And if you think about asylum or refugees, they only can claim asylum or refugee status once they arrive at a territory. So there's a certain premium on arrival. If we shift borders and if we have remote forms of control, then of course the ability of these people to approach a specific territory and to claim asylum status is not there anymore. So it becomes more difficult for them to do that. And she is basically talking about ways to regain the legal status also at different places. Because why do Western states do that? Why do they use forms of remote control? Yeah, for exactly the purpose to circumvent their own legal or sometimes constitutional commitments. But if you cannot arrive at a specific territory, then of course no one could claim asylum. And in the European Union, we have this safe third country rule. But if you are surrounded by a safe country, then it's basically impossible to go to a country and to ask to become an asylum seeker. You cannot do that because you always have crossed other countries, or you went via a plane, then the plane would not take you on board because you have no paper that allows to approach a territory.
It's a really interesting conversation about that towards the end of the book, right? Really important issues. And I think a great place for us to close. But first, I'd like to ask, what are you working on now?
Yeah, I'm currently working on a book, also a book in German, on a new so-called conflict arenas. And we have done a large empirical studies on so the structure and the content of societal conflicts, in terms of inequality conflicts, but also in terms of migration conflicts, climate conflicts, and so-called identity politics conflicts. And so we have written a larger book, a bigger book, and that will come out end of this year, hopefully.
All right. Well, I hope to see it in English at some point in the future. It's been wonderful talking with you today about this book. And you do have a few other books in English, which I'll put on the page for this podcast as well. So listeners can check those out too. For now, thank you for coming on the show. And thank you everyone else for tuning in. Once again, my name is Katriona Gold, and I've been speaking with Stefan Mao about his new book, Sorting Machines, The Reinvention of the Border in the 21st Century, which was translated by Nicola Barfoot and published by Polity in 2022. I highly recommend picking up a copy from your local bookstore, direct from Polity, or from any other ethical retailer. Thanks all for listening, and thanks again, Stefan, for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me.